This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is an edited recording of the panel discussion that was held at the BFM Health and Living Live 2016 event on April 2nd. BFM Health and Living Live 2016 is presented by AIA, the real life company. Hello everyone, welcome to the panel, and we're going to be talking about managing cancer, but also we're going to be talking about reducing the fear surrounding cancer. And just to introduce my panel, we have Dr. Muralini Santhirathesan, Medical Director of AIA Health Services. We have Dr. Sandri Somasundaram, President of the National Cancer Society. And then right here, we have Associate Professor Dr. Fuad Ismail, Senior Consultant Oncologist at Gleneagles, as well as Head of the Oncology Department in HUKM. And right over there, Dr. Limran Jai, Subject Matter Expert in Herbal Medicine from the National Cancer Institute, and he's going to be covering our complementary treatment angle today. So as you can kind of surmise, we have people who are coming from very different angles. So since I have such a very diverse panel up here with me, I wanted to start with, what do you all think are the main challenges we face in managing cancer as a disease from your perspectives?
Okay. In terms of a perspective of an NGO and a patient group organization, I think the main issues that we have, one is stigma, which is still associated with cancer, and two, the fatalism that Malaysians have in relation to cancer. And because of that, issues that crop up are, one, people don't believe in prevention of cancer, people don't believe that cancer can be found early, and when cancer is found early, because of the fatalistic attitude and the stigma associated with cancer, they don't go for treatment early enough either. So everything snowballs. And then, of course, then your cost of cancer increases as well. So that whole stigma and fatalism is the crux for me in terms of the management of cancer.
Dr. Boyd?
I agree with what was said. I think one of our issues is there's quite a few cancers which can be detected early and people should go for certain types of screening. And number two is that when you are diagnosed with cancer, you should come for treatment, because getting the diagnosis only doesn't help. You actually need to come for treatment, and there's a lot of stigma associated with treatment, and people tend to look at chemotherapy or radiotherapy as very heavy treatment, but so they tend to shy away until, and they come back later, the disease is worse, and then they need even more treatment. So it sort of feeds their beliefs that the treatment is has a lot of side effects. And the third is the rising cost of cancer treatment now. There's a lot of new therapies. If we look back 20 years ago, there's only perhaps one or two new drugs a year. We probably get about 10 or 20 new drugs a year. And as the drugs are developed, they become more and more costly over time. So cost is a big issue now.
Exactly. I mean, riding on what Fuad said, cost is the major issue when it comes to cancer. And if you're talking about insurance, not everyone has any means of insurance to support that or to enable them to access the cancer care that they need when they're diagnosed with cancer. Insurance is a visible means of, you know, peace of mind that you have when you're diagnosed with a dreaded disease like cancer. So one of the main challenges in terms of cancer would be the cost. Knowing what's the right care that you should have, getting access to that care, getting treated, and getting diagnosed as early as you can so that your options for treatment is in abundance compared to when you're diagnosed at a very late stage. Then the cost escalates, and then the access to that care will become a lot more challenging.
Dr. Lim, what about from a complementary therapy perspective?
Okay, from my clinical practice, what we observe the most is most of the patients, when they've been referred to our clinics, they have gone through most of the conventional treatments. So sometimes there's no active management, and some of them can't even take orally. They can't really take the medicine. This point of time, when they've been referred to our clinics, actually nothing much we can actually offer. That's one of it. So late referral is one of the concerns. Secondly, it's about the gap between the so-called traditional and complementary medicine practitioner with the conventional medicine. They don't really understand each other. So because of this gap there, it's actually delay the treatment. I mean, it's a more appropriate treatment from a conventional side sometimes. And lastly, I agree with most of the panels whereby cost. Even in the complementary treatment, the cost is always the concern. You can't really imagine how heavy will be the burden of using complementary medicine?
Well, from that, I kind of wanted to pick up two main things. Firstly, both you, Dr. Soundary, and you, Dr. Fuad, mentioned that people are either not coming early enough for screenings or diagnosis, and then after that, not following through early enough on treatment. Why do you think people are putting it off? Why are people not going through to the next step, which is treatment?
One of the things is that cancer treatment has more side effects than other treatment. If you talk about surgery, when you have cancer surgery, you actually, they call it radical surgery. You need to remove quite a few bits. So if you have a cancer of the colon, you need to remove perhaps 18 centimeters or more of your colon. It sounds like a lot. If you have breast cancer, you need to, sometimes you need a mastectomy. Sometimes you can get away with a lumpectomy. Obviously, if you come early, then let's say you have a small breast lump, then you need a smaller treatment. You need smaller surgery. But the thought of surgery puts a lot of people off. Even earlier during the cardio session, they said that, oh, I'm not going for coronary bypass where possible. So the same thing, they think that there are treatments out there which they can avoid surgery, or they can avoid chemotherapy or avoid radiotherapy. So cancer is a tough disease, and you do need fairly strong treatment. But we have ways of mitigating some of the side effects and making it a lot easier for the patients. But that's, I think, is the main thing, the fear of the treatment.
I mean, yes, I agree with Fuad in terms of the treatment. But I think way before the treatment aspect of it is that there's too much noise out there when it comes to cancer. When someone is diagnosed with cancer, you'll get 100 people coming up to you, people you've never known before, or family of this, whoever. They will come up to you and give you advice. And with all that noise, it's very, very hard to make a decision on what to do next. And it's very, very hard for the family as well, just not for the person who has cancer. But in Malaysia, where decision-making is a family-centric activity, it's not like Western countries where you as a person can make your own decisions. The doctor will listen to you and no one else. In Malaysia, it's different. The doctor listens to the family because that's our culture. It is a family-centric decision-making process. And because of that, with all the noise coming in, it's very, very difficult for anybody to make decisions. And that causes the delay as well. Because once you've decided on something, someone else will come up and say, no, you know, why don't you try this first or something else first? And if it's less invasive than the surgery, et cetera, they're more willing to try that. And that might not be the right treatment. So by the time they go for the surgery and the chemotherapy or whatever treatments they need in terms of conventional, the whole scenario has changed from when they're first diagnosed. So then your treatments have to be more aggressive. And that gives a negative feedback all over again. And that's what people remember. They don't remember the amount of time that they actually wasted in their decision-making process or trying other treatments. So we need to work out ways to mitigate this. We need to work out ways of how can we stop this from happening, or at least create more awareness for people, or give them avenues in which they can explore information which is out there in an easier manner, so they can digest it and make quicker decisions.
Well, part of the reason for all that noise, I suppose, is because it's so deeply frightening. Cancer, you know, cancer scares people literally to death sometimes. And with you, Dr. Fuad, I would imagine that there is this concept that cancer treatments continue to be, as you say, frightening, aggressive. People find them very intimidating. Can you take us through the more common treatment modalities and maybe go a little way towards de-scarifying it for us, so to speak?
Okay, first, I try not to look too scary to my patients. Hopefully it works. Well, the oldest form of cancer treatment is surgery. That's been around for thousands of years. And conceptually, it's very easy. You have got a lump, you remove it, and hopefully that will settle things. Then comes radiotherapy. Radiotherapy or radiation was discovered about the turn of the 20th century. So you shoot these strong X-rays. Imagine they are similar to what you get for a chest X-ray, but these X-rays are stronger and they're targeted towards the cancer cells and not throughout the whole body. So that's radiotherapy. And then the third, the one that people are usually frightened of is chemotherapy. Essentially, these are drugs which goes all over the body. So we have three different main modalities. The first two are local treatments. Surgery removes the cancer at its point of origin. Radiotherapy shoots at the cancer at the point of origin. And chemotherapy is trying to deal with the worst aspect of cancer, the fact that it can go everywhere to your body. So you get a drug either by mouth or mostly by injection. It goes all over the body trying to target where the cancers could have gone. So that's chemotherapy. But now we have two other newer modalities. One is called the targeted therapies, and these are specifically targeting certain aspects of the cancer. Let's say the cancer has got very little hair or has got like white hair like me, so it might target just people with white hair, something like that. So those are the targeted therapies. And the last one, which has been around again for the last 30 years, is immune therapy, where you're trying to get your own body to stimulate your own body to attack the cancer cell. Not as easy as it sounds. The immune system is very good at targeting things like bacteria and viruses because they are alien to your body. But cancer cell is from your own body. So they are the same cells in your body. They've just changed to become malignant, yeah, or cancers. And the body has to differentiate which are the normal cells, which are the malignant cells.
Now, before we move on to complementary medicine, I'd just like to open up the floor at this point. Does anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask our panel?
I noticed that in China, they actually have the Western and the traditional medicine being practiced at the same time in their hospitals. Now, I would like to know your comments and whether are we going to have such in our hospitals?
Okay, I did my specialty in Shanghai. What I can share with you is, you're right in the sense that whereby the chemotherapy and radiotherapy, they actually go concurrently with the herbal treatment. But I would say what we have, the data, the evidence there is actually the patients is able to do better compared to those receiving the chemotherapy only. The data we're collecting there, that's I would say it's a very encouraging response. But again, there are some concerns which still cannot be resolved, especially when we bring this in back to Malaysia, which is the safety, the drug-herb interaction I always emphasize. That's why in Malaysia, our approach of using the herbal treatment is more towards a complementary, saying that to reduce the side effects from the conventional treatment. But again, here when we work together with our oncologists, our consensus will be this should not be the things that we practice in Malaysia, and there's more and more evidence actually supporting that.
We are trying to get more evidence for the use of traditional medicine, and the only way forward is actually to do more research on it. So that has to work hand in hand. So we do have anecdote, people saying that this works and so on, but that is not good enough in terms of evidence for us to change our practice. So we are trying to work with people in TCM section in Putrajaya and so on, trying to get more research to see where these drugs can have a place or these herbs can have a place with our conventional treatment.
We'll take a couple more. Does anyone have any other questions?
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Alan. When we talk about the cancer, right, once your neighbor or people know about cancer, right, a lot of people suddenly become a medical expert. So how do we overcome, how to handle this? Because doctors say one thing, these experts say one thing. Thank you.
For those who have joined the earlier session, you know, Dr. Azani talked a lot about getting evidence for treatment. So usually when you say evidence, we compare. You know, sometimes if you get headache, you take Panadol, it works, but the next time it might not work. So we know that treatment varies, the results varies with people. So when we say that a treatment works, usually, let's say we take 100 patients and I try it on drug A, and then next 100 patients I try it on drug B. So on average, I'll say 70% of these people did better on drug A and 50%. So we say drug A is better. No treatment works in 100%. So that's why we need to find the difference, which is better. But for a lot of the supplements and the other alternative therapy, they can't provide you with that evidence. And then they say that Mr. A or Mr. B tried this and it worked, so I think you should try it. While the doctors are a bit boring in that way, we say, oh, 70%, 50%, and what does these figures mean? But we can only offer you, we always tell you that if you want, you can read it up. This is what the statistics show. My suggestion is go have a talk with your doctor, your surgeon or oncologist, and then see what do you need for that treatment, and then you make that decision after you have all the knowledge.
All right, final question from the floor for now.
Good afternoon. Now, we have heard about treatment of cancer, and we know that it is not working well. It's a sure death at the end of the day. But may I know whether the medical profession has found out what are the causes of cancer?
I would disagree with what you said on two points. One is cancer is not a sure death. Be very clear about that. There are more and more people living with cancer than there are dying of cancer in many parts of the world. The reason why it's an issue in Malaysia is, as we mentioned before, people are coming late. Now, there are many reasons why people come late. Yes, there are inequalities of our health system, but the responsibility also lies on us as individuals to actually learn more about cancer. Which comes to your second question in terms of prevention. We don't know everything there is to know about cancer, but we do know that our risk for cancer can be reduced. And the biggest thing out there is tobacco. Tobacco is linked to 1/3 of all cancers. So if you prevent tobacco usage, you will decrease the number of people getting cancer. That is the responsibility of every single one of us, not just in this room, but in Malaysia. That when you go out there and you talk about tobacco, people say it's part of our culture. In what way is tobacco part of our culture? So we have to change our perceptions and we have to change our behaviors and attitudes to things that can prevent cancer. Earlier on you talked about obesity, etc. Obesity is the next big thing in terms of cancer prevention. So yes, there are things that you can do out there in terms of cancer.
I mean, when you talk about cancer, everybody's so worried to say the word cancer. When somebody gets diagnosed with cancer, you say muffled tones, you say cancer. Yeah? We need to embrace cancer. It's not the end of the world, right? I mean, I'm sure you'll all agree with me sitting in this hall here. So with all that awareness that you have with the advent of internet, everybody reads. When you read, you need to be able to do something about it. You know the early symptoms of cancer. Seek out the assistance of a doctor, right? Find out a little bit more. Find out what are your options for treatment. And then you look back and think, do I have the means to pay for that treatment? Where do I go? Where do I look out for this means to pay for the treatment? What can I afford? What can I do? Yeah, so that's how you need to embrace cancer, and it's not something that it's a taboo that you should not talk about it. And I think going forward, that's how people should, you know, embrace cancer. Yeah.
What was mentioned that cancer is incurable is really not true. If you have stage 1 breast cancer, the chance of cure is about 90%. If it's stage 2, it's maybe about 70%. The problem is a lot of people are coming stage 3 and 4. Stage 4 cancer is extremely, extremely difficult to cure. Most of the time it's not curable. You're down to single digits for anything. So, and stage 3 is only about 30%. So if you come at stage 1, for many cancers, the cure is well above 80%.
And that's interesting because I'm going to just mix a bunch of messages that are coming in via Twitter. Overall, there is a sense that people want to know how early they can get detected, how early they can know their own risks. But the questions are very general and they are different for different cancers. But by and large, where do we stand in terms of screenings and scans? Are enough people getting screened?
No, not enough people are being screened. I mean, screening has become a little bit controversial in terms of cancer because of breast cancer. People question whether to do mammograms or not to do mammograms, et cetera, et cetera. But it's very clear when you look at cancers in Malaysia as well and in other parts of the world is that women get cancer at a younger age. Okay, so for screening for women and screening for men are very, very different. For screening for women, because the two top cancers you're looking at are breast cancer and cervical cancer, there are investigations that you can do at a younger age. So for women, I would tell you, from your teenage years or you know your early 20s, be breast aware. Understand what your breasts feel like. Understand the changes that happen in your breast. Okay, I'm not telling you that, yes, you know, every month you should stand there in front of a mirror and do a breast examination, etc. That has gone out the window now in terms of investigations that people are asked to do. But being breast aware is very, very important because then you know if there's changes in your breast. Cervical cancer, do your pap smears. You know, we have one of the lowest rates of women doing pap smears, even though pap smears are widely available across the country. And even just doing one pap smear between the ages of 30 and 45 can actually decrease your risk of developing cervical cancer by 50%. So there are things that you can do. They're not incredibly invasive, but there are things that you can do to help yourself. For men, it's much later in life, you know, after the age of 50 in terms of screening tests. If you want to know more information, there's a lot of information actually on our website, in the National Cancer Society website. Or if you Google, you know, screening prevention, etc., I mean, screening guidelines, there are a lot out there and they're fairly generic.
Dr. Lim, in terms of complementary treatment, I think this is the key thing I wanted to know. What do you want people to understand about what it can and cannot do? Because a lot of people are taking it as a less invasive, less difficult silver bullet.
Okay, I'm talking about what it can do and not able to achieve, it would be. I would say here in Malaysia, we have set out a policy whereby the traditional and complementary medicine serves as an adjunct role. So in the other words, it's not an alternative for the cancer management. That's how we define the TNCM, traditional and complementary medicines. Maybe what I can share with my experience is I haven't seen a single cancer patient with a tumor totally disappear after taking the complementary treatment. That's why in our center, the common practice is when we are facing patients where they're only opted for traditional and complementary medicine, what we will advise them is, hey, look here. What we have with us is conventional medicines. We have the oncologist, we have the surgeon. Why not you're looking for something curative, something able to achieve better outcome compared to those opted to a more conservative. Because when we're facing cancer patients, one of the main things is they're so scared of oncologists. Because like what being mentioned by Prof. Watt, you have radiotherapy, you have chemotherapy. By the time they listen to these terms, they ran away. And then they'll hope on me. So my next question is, I will discuss with them. I think one of the main challenges we have is to share the information with our patients. Whether they have enough information to make the decisions. So we do play a role when we're receiving these type of patients, whereby, like what we mentioned, Prof. Watt, breast cancer, stage 1, about 94%, then why should you opt for something which evidence-wise cannot give you a promise? So why not get something else in the mainstream, get it done? Then you get cured. Isn't it better? Rather than opted for something else. That's actually our stance, especially in our center, and that's the way we're trying to educate our patients.
I mean, I won't lie, I was hoping for fist fights and, you know, blood on the floor between the two of you, but it seems like you have a pretty good working relationship. And earlier, Dr. Lim, you talked about, you know, how there is a gap that needs to be bridged between conventional treatment and complementary treatment. How are you working towards bridging that gap? I feel like a couples therapist. How is this working out for you?
We'll fight later.
In private.
Okay. I did involve in some of the policies last time, a few years back. So actually, the Ministry of Health is taking active roles in trying to upgrading the existing TNCM practitioners. One of it is they come with regulations. So for information, we have the TNCM Act, which has been passed in 2013. So all of the private practitioners, TNCM practitioners out there, they have to register with the governments later when it has been enforced. This is one to ensure the qualifications and the credibility of this TNCM practitioner. That's one thing. After that, the MOH is playing a very active role by upgrading them, equip them with the modern knowledge or the modern medicine knowledge. This is to tell them, okay, look at here. When you see a patient with a lump on your breast, it's not necessary because of heatiness. Okay? Because if all your information, Chinese medicines or some others, Malay medicines, Indian medicine, they do have some certain concepts and theory in diagnosing certain things. But bear this in mind, that might be a cancer. If you are not sure, please refer to a conventional medical doctors, let them diagnose. Till proven otherwise, it's still a cancer. So that's how the MOH is trying to doing the initiative in trying to improve form of bridging the gap.
Dr. Fuad, at what point does that referral work the other way?
Quite often the patients themselves ask for a referral, or at a point with advanced cancers when we say that, okay, we don't have much good choices. This is what we can do, but it's only might work in maybe 15 or 20% of patients. They say they want to try something else. At that point in time, you know, when patients have got very stark choices, then I say, okay, whatever you want to try, we can help you. We can monitor you. And let's play by the same rules. If you've got a lump and you say, I cannot cure you anymore, if you want to try some traditional or alternative medicine, I say, okay, fine, let's go ahead. if the lump gets bigger, then we'll say that it doesn't work. Is that fair enough? Right? Because sometimes they try other treatment, and then they think that the lump might grow bigger, and then it might burst, and it gets better. This is not an abscess. You know, it's not pus. The pus comes out, and the cancer gets better. In general, if cancer breaks through the skin, it's worse, and things go downhill from there. So at this point in time, I think we are still at the stage where TCM might come at a later stage, and then we'll see what happens. If you have a lump in your breast and treatment has failed, then you take something. Does the lump shrink? That would be the key question. If it works, the tumor should shrink, and then we can move on from that. If it works in the later stage, then we see whether it works in the earlier stage. So we are still at looking whether the TCM can come in at a later stage of cancer care.
Before we move on to the final section, which will be about cost, again, I'd like to open up the floor to questions. Has anyone got questions?
Hello, my name is Intan Sabrina. I'm a rehabilitation physician. Is cancer rehabilitation part of cancer management? Because a lot of my patients, they do not know that when you have cancer, especially if it has metastasized to the spinal cord, you can't control your urine, you cannot pass motion, you can't turn as much, so you'll end up with pressure ulcers. So what are your thoughts? How do we actually push? Cancer rehabilitation should be part and parcel of your management, not just limited to chemotherapy and surgery only. Thank you.
I think rehab plays a big part. Well, one, you have to be quite fortunate to have a rehab physician in your hospital. So that's one of the limitations. And we do have a lot of patients with very advanced disease. They've had fractures, they've had cord compression, they may even have some problems post-surgery, lymphedema of the arms. And those patients certainly do need rehab physicians to come and help us with their management. It is a big part of our practice as well. But most of the time we are left with essentially physiotherapy, because for our side, I think we have only two rehab physicians, so that is a big limitation what they can help us with.
Next question, gentleman in blue.
My name is Michael. I've got two questions. The first one for Dr. Lim. Can you please comment on the myth or the truth of the efficacy of the Saba snake grass in helping with cancer treatment? The second one is, chemotherapy tries to kill the cancer before it kills the patient. So can you please address that? Thank you.
Saba snake grass. I believe there are plenty of people who will approach them, and one of the products they are selling to this patient would be on the Saba snake grass. But what I can share with you is, these are so-called local herbs, local folk herbs. It's different from what they've been practiced in the traditional Chinese medicine. Traditional Chinese medicine, the single herbs inside the system has been used for 2,000 years plus, first thing. Secondly, it has been extensively studied in China for the past 100 years. So we have two brick-like books for Chinese material medica. So it has been stated, what are the dosage, how long you can take it, whether there's any liver toxicity, whether there's any kidney damage potential. This is Chinese herbal treatment, herbal medicine. But when you talk about Saba snake grass, one of the major concerns I always tell my patient is lack of research. We do not have enough data for us to use it. We cannot deny, maybe one day later, there are some scientists, they're able to derive active ingredient from this Saba snake grass. But at least at the moment of time, we do not have a very solid safety profile of what medication I'm using. In that sense, not really we encourage our patients to simply take any unknown product or even unknown herbs.
Dr. Fuad, what's chemotherapy trying to kill?
Not the patient, I hope. Yeah. Otherwise, my clinic would be rather empty. But let's look at the facts. If you have a leukemia 100 years ago, it's a death sentence. Nobody survived leukemia, right? So when chemotherapy came about 1940s, 1950s, then people started to cure leukemias. And right now, 2016, the cure for childhood leukemia, especially acute leukemia, is in well in excess of 50%. For something that cannot be cured at all, to more than 50%. If we look at testicular cancer, even in advanced disease, we can cure 50% of them with chemotherapy. And in earlier stages, we cure about 80 or 90%. So certain cancers are very exquisitely sensitive to chemotherapy. chemotherapy is also used in different contexts, right? Sometimes quite often in solid tumors like breast, colon, it is used as part of the treatment as an adjunct or sometimes used in advanced disease. So in advanced disease, when we use it, we are trying to alleviate the symptoms, we are trying to make the patients feel better. Now I was going to, how can you make patients feel better with chemotherapy? That's not possible. No, it's not true. Some patients who have advanced cancer, they've got big livers, they've got tumors which are bleeding, they cannot breathe and so on, then they have chemotherapy. And if the chemotherapy works, then the tumors become smaller, they can breathe again, they can eat, they stop vomiting, they can pass motion normally. But again, you have to look at, this is the context of advanced setting, we alleviate the symptoms for a certain amount of time. Say if you have colon cancer, you may get relief from your symptoms for about 6 months, then you need another therapy. But people forget that she had chemotherapy and 6 months later they're so much worse. That must be because of the chemotherapy. It's not true, because the chemotherapy has done its job for that period of time and now it's worse again. And this is what happens in advanced cancer. They become resistant to treatment A, then you need treatment B. Then you may need treatment C. But beyond treatment C, beyond two or three lines, that usually the drugs don't work very well already. So you may have one good first-line treatment, a second okay second line, by the time you come to third or fourth line, it's difficult. So, but everything is blamed on the chemotherapy. They don't see it as the cancer not responding to treatment and it's the cancer getting worse, not that the chemotherapy has actually done it in for them.
And our final question from the floor before we move on to cost.
Hi, just a quick introduction. In 2008, I was diagnosed with a first-stage brain cancer, and I've been in remission for 5 years. So my question is because I was diagnosed in the States and I was lucky enough to be able to use medical marijuana as a complementary, how far are we in Malaysia to consider medical marijuana as a complementary treatment, as well as to look into further studies, either clinical or as a part of treatment or management of cancer in Malaysia?
I would say it's a big issue. And anything that we would like to bring into Malaysia, we need the evidence at the back, scientific evidence. There's no single interventions or complementary treatment can easily enter into any countries without a scientific data at the back. So not only medical marijuana, but actually in traditional and complementary medicines, we have a wide spectrum of so-called treatment which you can't really imagine. For example, crystal healing. So there are a lot of this type of so-called treatment, actually, they are trying to enter into Malaysia as well. I think what we will look into for the moment of time, anything to come into Malaysia would be on the scientific background. If there are not enough scientific evidence, it's difficult to come to us. And I believe in our mainstream that we will not simply accept that as one of the treatment.
Moving on to cost. Dr. Miralini, maybe let's go into what people need to be doing in order to financially prepare themselves for cancer.
Traditional insurance product usually covered a broad band of diseases, but the insurance industry has evolved with trends, and we have targeted specific products that would just cover you for cancer. Traditional products usually cover you when you're in your final or when you're in your more advanced stage of cancer. And currently we have a lot more newer products that will cover you, that will pay for your excess of care in early stages of cancer, when you're advanced stages of cancer, as well as give you a little bit of living benefit to help you in the next few years to help you have quality of life. So in terms of cancer care, in terms of the insurance industry, we have evolved. We have come out with more target-specific products to address cancer, as we understand that cancer is a huge burden. The cost of paying for cancer is a huge burden.
So what does that preparedness entail? If I am thinking ahead, I mean, earlier there were questions coming in about how you can prepare for cancer if you don't even know your risks, if you don't know when it's going to come, if you don't know at what stage you're going to have to go for treatment. Am I going to spend my whole life just financially preparing for it? I mean, because people want to do things, you know, they don't necessarily just want to prepare for the worst, prepare for what's bad.
The concept of insurance is basically your insurability. It's your age, the risk that you entail. So the advice that I would give you is buy when you're young, when you're healthy, and then when you need it, you'll be able to use it. right? Don't wait when you already have a pre-existing illness or you've got some sort of an illness to then seek out insurance cover. Then your insurability becomes difficult and you may not be able to get the cover that you need. There are MyRider products out there. Seek out some sort of advice when it comes to the right financial protection that you need. Don't think that insurance is something of a luxury, that you don't need it. You do need it. The out-of-pocket expenses of cancer care in a recent the ASEAN study showed that more than 50% of people diagnosed with cancer after 1 year they were in financial catastrophe. Now, financial catastrophe means having to come out with 30% more of out-of-pocket expenses. This is to help you pay for your bills, to help you lead some sort of a quality of life. Now, 1 year after being diagnosed of cancer, that's a short time, right? What happens after that? You need to be able to have that financial means to be able to go on, to be able to pay for your children's schooling and do what you want to do, yeah? So buy insurance when you're early, seek out the right financial protection, seek out the right advice.
Dr. Fuad, how does having insurance affect a patient's treatment, in your experience?
It does affect it quite a lot. The government does offer a lot of cancer care at minimal cost. I mean, surgery is fairly cheap. Radiotherapy will only cost you a few hundred or 1 or 2,000 ringgit. And the cost of chemotherapy is perhaps 1 or 200 ringgit. The actual cost of this treatment is probably tenfold of what's being charged. But when you come to a certain stage and when you come to the more expensive drugs, sometimes these drugs are not covered by the services offered, and then you may want to consider buying them. So you have the out-of-pocket expenses. So some of the newer therapies are not available readily from the Ministry of Health, and then you may need these drugs, and that's where the expenses kick in. So if you have insurance, whether it's personal insurance or through companies and so on, then you have a little bit more options. It's not that the service offered by Ministry of Health is not bad. It's really pretty good. But additional insurance gives you that a little bit of an edge or maybe access to some of the newer therapies that's available.
Okay, we're out of time. I mean, this is a huge topic to cover in one panel. But if you would all like to just give your final thoughts on how we should be living with managing cancer, as well as just not whispering cancer, but being able to talk about it openly and deal with it.
I think the best advice that you can give your children, yeah, is to have the right financial protection. Seek out whatever is available in the market. Know what are your options. Know what you can afford. There's something for everyone in the market. And buy when you're healthy. You will need it when the time comes.
For me, I think come for treatment early. If you're diagnosed, come for treatment early. If you decide to become Dr. Google yourself, then try to look at reliable websites. You know, you can look at National Cancer Institute US websites, what's being offered, what are the chances of cure for cancer of the pancreas or brain cancer, whatever it is. Then you know what your chances are, what stage you're in. And don't close your mind to its treatment. Always come, have a discussion, and then we can tell you what are the likely chance of success, whatever stage you are in, and then you make a decision. Don't run away. When you're diagnosed, come and have a chat with your surgeons or your oncologist first.
I think I mirror what Ford said in that sense. Find out good information. Two is communicate. I think a lot of the issues which occur is that there's no communication between patient and doctor, patient and family, because a lot of decisions are made by families which don't take into account what the patient wants themselves as well. So communication is huge. If you have issues trying to understand the language or to understand what the diagnosis actually means, there are many NGOs, including the National Cancer Society of Malaysia, that you can come to and we can sit down with you and discuss it with you, go through it. We don't give you advice on what treatment you should have, but what we do is we break down the information for you so it's easier for you to understand it and so you can talk to your doctor about it as well. So there are a lot of organizations which do that. And as Fuad said, there are very reliable websites as well that you can go to which also break it down for you.
For the complementary treatment, I would say it's always query. Always query the ones who offer you the complementary treatments about the qualifications, the safety of their products. Keep on asking. Don't make rush decisions, especially when you have been first diagnosed with cancer. because there are hundreds of experts will approach you. So keep on asking what you are selling me. Is it really helpful in my conditions? And always back to the mainstream whereby there's enough evidence to support on what they're using.
On that note, to keep on asking, unfortunately, we've run out of time. And that is it. Thank you so much. On to the next. This is an edited recording of the panel discussion that was held at the BFM Health and Living Live 2016 event on April 2nd. BFM Health and Living Live 2016 is presented by AIA, the real life company.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.